When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
If one big beautiful bill has left you with one big confusing question, turn to BHM CPA Group. Their experienced professionals break down complex changes in tax law, accounting, and business regulations so you can make informed decisions with confidence. Simplifying the complex is what BHM CPA Group does best. Don't wait. Visit bhmcpagroup.com and let's get to work. BHM, because running a business is hard enough. Your finances shouldn't be. Visit bhmcpagroup.com today.
Welcome, everybody, to the show. Today, we're joined by Dr. Patrick Ferran, a leadership expert with 25 years of experience guiding Fortune 100 startups, nonprofits through change and culture transformation. As the founder of Ad Lucem Group and the former Notre Dame MBA faculty, Patrick brings PhD level insights to helping leaders thrive in meaningful, lasting change. Not to mention that he's also a triathlete, which we'll get into later in the episode. But with all of that, Patrick, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, definitely. Just to jump right in, Patrick. Well, first, let's start with telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, and then we'll jump.
Yeah, so I consider, you know, briefly, my dad was an iconic teacher of 47 years, and my mom was a gerontological researcher, worked with Alzheimer's caregiver patients. And I think both in my DNA and my upbringing, they inculcated for me a love of service, right? And not to be trite, but I feel like my life's mission is to leave this world a better place. And for me, one of the pieces that I most enjoy, I feel a calling to really coaching and developing others. I enjoy teaching and so forth. I was a high school teacher in my early career, spent 20 plus years in corporate consulting world, and you know, founded my own practice a number of years ago and continue to work in a higher education capacity as well. And the unifying thread throughout that time has been just the joy that I get from walking on the journey with other folks who are trying to better themselves, better those around them, better the organizations they serve and so forth. And being party to that and witness to that is profoundly meaningful.
Yeah, that's beautiful. A life of service. Aren't we all like supposed to be, you know?
We hope so, right?
Yeah, definitely. What do you find, just to jump right in here, what do you find is the attribute of people who seek sort of like your professional services in coaching and development as a leader?
Well, I think in terms of folks that we really resonate with, we would call them purpose driven, right? And everyone's purpose is going to manifest differently. But someone who is really being mindful and intentional about the kind of leader they want to be, the kind of work they want to contribute to, how they want to show up in the world. And there's not a one size fits all there, but we're not out to try to evangelize the importance of purpose necessarily so much as for help understand folks how to tap into that in a way that's meaningful to them, how to engage their team members in a way that's authentic, and do so in a way that has very practical implications throughout the organization and throughout the ripple effects of that work.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So you help guide leaders through a lot of the most turbulent times in organizations. And so when everything feels so uncertain, and we're kind of going through those times right now, right? What is the first anchor that you recommend a leader to hold on to?
You know, going back to the purpose is one of those, right? And we have an upcoming book where we talk about the centering on your own, both your individual purpose, what is your why? And then helping folks tap into that for themselves. And then importantly, if you're working in the context of a team or an organization, tapping into that organizational purpose. And to the extent that you can create alignment in terms of what does that mean? How does that manifest for us if we're aligned to this particular purpose and how we're showing up together? That alignment can help the teams become more resilient and work through those challenges.
Okay. So how do I find my purpose? Let's say I'm just a leader who's come up through the organization without consciousness of it. I'm just good at my job. And so now I'm here and I need to navigate through some uncertainty, and I don't know what the purpose, I don't know what my purpose is. How do you guide me through that?
Well, I think that for some folks, they will have a clear sense that this is, they may not know the words necessarily, but these are things, you know, like starting with what are some values that are important to you, for instance? What are times in your life and your work where you have found a deep sense of meaning? And what can we derive from that? What do you think that's telling you? Right? If you particularly, in my case, for example, I really enjoy coaching and working with folks. So what kind of insights can I draw from that, for instance? Ideally, an organization will have an articulated mission statement, purpose, and so forth. Sometimes there needs to be some, you know, coalescing around what does that mean for us, and how do we carry out and fulfill this this purpose. Sometimes organizations, especially startups, need to do some work there, and there's an opportunity to co-create some of that. And what do we think our purpose is, as either an individual team level or more broadly within the organization, if we don't have that well defined? So doing that in conversation can be very helpful. There's, again, sometimes for folks it's clear, we just need to kind of think about the words and what are the implications of that. Other times you can do sort of the bottom up and thinking about those experiences and what insights can we draw, and that can be very helpful for that in introspection.
Yeah, and how do you help people who have certain values or missions on their own? How do you help them tie that back into the organization that they work for?
Yeah, so I liken it to, you know, one of my co-founder and co-author, she was the coxswain for, she went to Harvard and got to Yale and, you know, for the team. And we often liken the metaphor of, you know, you want to be rowing in the same direction, right? And,
yeah.
And we're not always aware of the friction that we create when we're not in alignment. So I think taking stock at the front end is a really important exercise. We have a number of different ways and some guided exercises. And then we actually, in our book, we've got some upcoming reflection exercises that'll be available to help teams and individuals sort of pull those things out of the toolkit, so in those areas where they might need help through this. But in its essence, it's really taking a step back and taking that stock on what does this mean for us? What am I about? What kinds of challenges do we bump up against? I'm going to paraphrase this quote. I'm going to butcher, but Friedrich Nietzsche. So basically, and Viktor Frankl popularized this quote and sentiment. They both had a sentiment that if we are clear on our why, a big enough why, we can endure anyhow. And so Viktor Frankl actually researched Holocaust survivors and so forth, and in his research, he found that folks who are really centered on why, what do I have to live for? What's important to me? And why am I doing what I'm doing? And how am I going to get through this? It helps us get through those challenges and those turbulent times. And that's, I mean, there's not many more extreme cases that you might find. There was certainly in more benign instances within organizations, there's going to be challenges. In our personal lives, there's going to be challenges. And so if we're really clear with ourselves why we're doing what we're doing, that helps us know, this is why I'm getting up this morning. This is why I'm going through this. This is why I have to endure X. And that'll help us work through those.
Sure, sure. And sometimes like companies have really big mission and vision statements. But if you can find, you know, that small thread of like where you contribute, you know, although it's big and audacious, I do agree with you. And if you can find that one small space where you excel or where you can contribute, I think that that helps you grow your why as well.
Yeah, there's many ways to help fulfill purpose, right?
For sure.
And that's
right?
The idea of it.
Yeah, there's many ways to help fulfill purpose. I like that. Very good. What does holistic leadership look like and what does it mean to you?
So for me, I think of a couple things come to mind, and in no particular order necessarily. I find that holistic leaders start. I recently listened to one of your podcasts with Thomas Knoll, and I really resonated with it. In that
so
particular
good.
Conversation, he talked about coming with an attitude of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think another way to frame that is having the humility that you don't have all the answers.
That's yes.
Right. And so recognizing that there's something to be said for having confidence and having the ability to, you know, set clear process and sort of guide the ship, so to speak. But some leaders sort of fall into the trap of feeling like they need to be the smartest person in the room. They need to have all the answers, and they carry, you know, sometimes they get explicit messages from the board or, you know, other peers in terms of what their missive is. Sometimes they put that onus on themselves and they create a challenge for themselves that they don't necessarily need to. That's not a burden they have to carry by themselves.
Right.
And so I think a holistic leader is one who comes in and recognizes, first of all, it's not my job to have all the answers. Right. And so having some humility around that, having strong opinions and a strong idea, there's held loosely, That can be powerful, right?
Yes.
So here's a hypothesis I have. Here's something I want to test out. How does that feel? Particularly for new leaders or new in a particular organizational context, one of the very practical things we talk about is thinking about how can you engage your stakeholders in a listening tour, for instance. And so that brings me to one of the other points I think is really important is how do you give voice to those that you're going to work? So a holistic leader is really interested, genuinely interested in what others' perspectives are. That comes back to the curiosity piece. Thinking about how can you know, I'm a big proponent of co-creation as well. And this is not, you know, not from a consensus, complete democracy kind of perspective, not this Pollyannish, right? But it can be done in the right context and for the right circumstances. But we often omit that from a process. And what happens is people lose agency. And so that comes, I would say, another tenet that comes back to is we want to give respect and trust, agency, and voice to people. So holistic leaders try to practice those and try to create, you know, the conditions that will support those for their team members as well. Not an exhaustive list, but those are some top of mind things that come to mind.
That's so good. And let's expand on agency, right? Because I don't think that leaders know that it's almost critical component to people feeling valued, right? So if you remove agency from people, consciously, unconsciously, what are the things in your experience that can happen by almost default?
The number one thing I say is it ultimately leads to burnout. If you're in a chronic situation of agency, it's counterintuitive. Overwork can contribute to, it can be a manifestation of burnout. But the reality is the loss of agency is a bigger contributing factor. And again, if you don't have agency, the amount of work you're doing, that's one way. But folks who have a deep sense of purpose and they have the ability to decide how and when they work and kind of how they show up, you know, that can suddenly they're able to do all sorts of things. And I'm doing things that I'm deeply driven by that I look at. There's no reason I should be doing other than that. It brings me joy, right?
Right.
It kind of fulfills my purpose either in the work context or as an avocation. I enjoy community theater, for instance.
Yeah.
So I'm doing these evening rehearsals when it's like it's adding stuff to my load, but it brings me joy. I have agency, right? Now, if someone said, you have to go do this and it's being dictated, and certainly in a work context, that's going to deprive me of my ability to find the joy. And so, you know, that burnout contribution is probably the number one thing that I see there. It's the silent killer, if you will, of engagement. So you'll see folks, if you're in that chronic state where folks have been deprived of agency, there's, you know, all the terms we've seen over the years, the silent quitting and the resignation, whatever label you want to put on. But that's really, folks start to check out. They don't give their best. Right. Counterintuitively, we're trying to have our teams perform at their best and become high performers. We wonder why is the team not showing up the way we know what they're capable of. And sometimes it's because we've put an arbitrary return to office policy, for example, on folks. Or we've said, you've got to work these particular hours, or you can't take time off for that daycare or this or that. And when we ask ourselves what's really behind that, it's often from a place of fear as a leader or as an organization. Presumably we've hired good people. And we want to support them and so forth. But the minute we start stripping them of that agency, we devolve in terms of what they're capable of, how they're feeling, and that folks will get burnout, they'll leave, et cetera. And it's unfortunate, but that's what we tend to see.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I tell leaders all the time, when you see a lack of innovation, when you see people not solving the problem, that's because you've been solving their problems for them. They no longer have to think. And until you bring it up and you solve it, we're just going to keep doing the wrong thing over and over again, you know, and it's such a shame because I know people wake up and they want to do the right thing.
I think you said something really interesting that I want to pull a thread on.
Sure.
You know, it's also agency to solve your own problems,
of course.
And dive in and so forth. So it's a really powerful and often overlooked area as well. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. Great. Great conversation. So ethical leadership is important. And so, you know, the conversation of ethics, you know, it's such a good one because it's not yes or no, right? It's when to break the rules and when not to break the rules. And it's often scrutinized. But what are some common ethical blind spots that you see, even with the most well-intentioned leaders?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just offer a couple sort of premises, absolutely, if you will. And I think one, first of all, we all live on an ethical continuum and we're making ethical decisions in almost every decision, arguably, that we make in a day. We don't realize it because we've already made, you know, sort of established certain patterns and norms. But the reality is every decision we make, to drive, to not, to, you know, what I wear, where my clothes are purchased from, what I eat, et cetera, right? There's all arguably ethical. Some of them become less obvious because we've inculcated to those, right? As we have within the context of an organization, I'm a big fan of Mary Gentile is a professor emeritus from UVA Darden, and she developed a curriculum called Giving Voice to Values. It's a very powerful framework. And one of her central tenets is that, right, the presumption is not that we need to teach people what's the right or wrong or the answer, because that implies a binary. The reality is there's so many complexities in a given situation. So it comes back to having respect to an agency to think about what that looks like. But what often organizations lack, and certainly leaders themselves and or how they, you know, taught their teams, how to think about giving voice to someone's ethics, right?
Sure.
How do we train one another and do that mental rehearsal? Where am I on a continuum with a particular issue?
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
And if that issue, her tenet was that if you thought about in advance of what, how you might respond to a particular situation, you're more likely to act on that in that situation. So it comes back to, if I draw the metaphor to your purpose, you know, and thinking about your purpose, it's also helpful to think about your values and your ethics. So you ask yourself implicitly or explicitly, if I'm ever presented with such a situation, what am I going to do? How can, and then the follow-on question is, how can I bring voice to that? What might I be able to give voice to that and have a constructive conversation around that, for instance? And I can give an example in our own practice, sure, for instance. One of our areas of support and services around diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? And we know the current landscape that's happening right now and so forth. And we've got some of our clients are having to thread an important needle with, you know, they're receiving federal funding and so forth, right? We're making the ethical decision that that's still important to us. It was important a few years ago. It's still important today. Whether we want to call it something different, that's a different discussion, right? But that's a value of ours. That's an ethic of ours. And so we've made the decision not to scrub our websites of saying these are some values that we hold, right? Recognizing that may have implications, right? Some people may say, well, we can't work with you, and we're okay with that. But we're trying to make intentional decisions around those ethics. And oftentimes we default into decisions or we go along with the crowd without getting political. We're seeing a lot of that in today's landscape, right? You know, how can we stand up in the face of a situation where we may not have authoritative power and there is a perceived ethical situation? How can we practice raising the hand, say, hey, I'd like to talk about.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got on a lot of tangents there, but I'll pause.
No, I love it. I love it. And I think that, you know, just having it on your website, and I think this is where maybe some people don't want to take a stand because they think that they need to be bold and brash about it, but you really don't, right? You can just humbly say, this is just one of my values and you can take it or leave it. You know, we're not walking around with picket signs to say that this is what we stand for. And I think that that's where, you know, I firmly stand on some of my beliefs and I understand that they may not be popular, but this is just what I stand for and it's okay, you know? So I appreciate the fact that you guys keep that on your website. And I think people are just scared. They're just scared of what everybody's going to think or because of the landscape that we're in. But if this is something that was important way before 2020, you know? And so you know, and we can see the value in diversity and inclusion, especially, well, both are equally important, but inclusion, right? Because just because we hire someone doesn't mean that we invite them to the meeting or to the party or whatever. But yeah, I think that leaders are often scared because of, like you said, groupthink and movement. But yeah, it's okay to stand for what you stand for, and you don't have to be audaciously brash about it, but holding it as your value is just part of who you are.
And I love that statement. If I could build on that, I think that, you know, that's what's unique to all of us
exactly.
as individuals and as a leader, right? And so to say, this is my value, like I'm not a political activist, right? I don't enjoy engaging in the political landscape, right? But I also am clear on what my values mm-hmm. are. And I, you know, I've decided here's how I'm going to be. Ad Lucem is Latin for to the light. As an organization, our purpose is try to be light to individuals and organizations we serve. So here are some better ways that are research-based that we have found in our extensive experience serve organizations effectively, right? For others, that may manifest that I want to go be a political activist, or I want to, or they may say on the other end of continuum, this is important to us, but we also need to thread a needle, and how can we do it in a way that we can maybe change the language, but hold true to some of the central tenets, et cetera. There's any number of ways. And that's the beauty of, again, honoring the complexities of these ethical situations. It's rarely a binary. I mean, the media and the politics like us to make us think it's a polar yes or no in whatever issue we're talking about. In my life, you know, I often joke with my friends when I went and did my PhD studies, I've never, you know, felt more dumb. The more I've learned, the more I realize how much there is to know and how complex things really are. And the more we try to simplify and come up with the exact right answer, the more skeptical I am of the person on the other side who has that perspective. So as leaders, honor the complexity, honor the different perspectives. Think about what does this mean? Be willing to change perspective. Be willing to shift and recognize that it can look different for different people. And that comes back to the diversity, right?
Yeah.
Diversity of thought and perspective and respect.
Yeah. The word "and" exists for a reason. You know, it doesn't have to be this or that for sure. Yeah. Let's shift into culture, because I feel like we were on our way there already. You know, culture transformation is a huge undertaking. It's a long game. And sometimes it can be intimidating. So how do you guys help leaders turn what they want their culture to look like, which can be a vague concept, into mm-hmm. something that's like tangible and actionable?
So the number one thing we always say is that you don't change culture by talking about and setting about to change culture. And by that, we mean that if that's the focus, culture is a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
It's a byproduct. You know, culture is built one conversation, one interaction, one process, one decision at a time. And so it comes back to, and again, this is why if you're clear on what your purpose and your values are, that sets some directional frame for what kind of culture would that look like? What do we want to support? So I'm not suggesting it's not important to talk and think about culture, but if you say, hey, this is the culture we want to have, now let's go create it, it doesn't work that way. On the other hand, if you say, hey, here are some things that are really important to us, maybe there's a strategic initiative or some kind of piece that we need to carry or something that we need to effectuate from a change perspective, et cetera. If we get something that we all care about and we all need to align on, and then we think about how do we want the process-wise, how do we want to work at this together? The culture becomes a byproduct of that joint work. When we learn how we row together, we set sort of the ground rules for how are we going to engage on this issue? How are we going to give people voice? How are we going to build this consensus? How are we going to work through this? What does this look like? You know, how do we deal with dissent? How do we deal with team conflict, et cetera? What are sort of the, you know, the rules of engagement, if you will? That's what's going to create the culture. It's not the ping pong tables, as we talk about in the book. You know, Marcus Buckingham calls those kinds of things the cultural plumage. It's not to say those don't have a place, but that's ancillary to how we centrally operate together.
What does plumage mean?
So it's, you know, the peacock
like
feathers.
A distraction. Sure.
It's
sure,
the peacock.
Sure.
We look can here. Put these things up and call it, these are our culture, right? We're a best place to work because we have all these wonderful things, but yet we backstab one another
and it sucks.
You know, have the meetings behind the meetings and all this stuff, right? So it's the stuff that we look at to show off to the world, say, hey, we have a great culture. And one of the other tenets that Buckingham talks about is, you know, culture is, you know, there's subcultures. And the culture that most of us experience is in the context of our immediate teams that we're in, you know,
sure.
a matrix organization, right? So it comes back to you can have some organizational tenets that you want to create from a cultural perspective, but the reality is people's lived reality is in that team unit with the leaders that they're working with and so forth. So it's really important that the leaders of those teams and units have perspectives that are aligned, that you provide them appropriate developmental support and so forth, because they are the most influential. You've probably heard the same people leave managers, they don't leave organizations, right? That's one way that culture will manifest itself.
Yeah. And so let's talk about hiring then, because, you know, we're hiring for leaders. How do they need to align with perhaps my values, knowing the culture that I would like to create? So what's the core? Because we want them to be different. We want diverse thought, diverse perspective. So what is your advice on how do we make sure we're all aligned?
We could have a whole separate conversation, a book on that topic alone. I think a couple tenets that come to mind there is thinking about hiring for values alignment is really important up front, versus what I often see folks do is they hire for the domain and functional experience. And that sort of becomes the primary focus. And the reality is a lot of that can be trained, right? I've seen how many ultimate fails. There's a pretty depressing stat out there that suggests, you know, the research has found that about 50% of executive transitions ultimately fail or are deemed a disappointment in the first 18 months. And a lot of, I've seen time and time again, how many times does an organization go out and do this exhaustive external search and they bring in a candidate, you know, has all the, again, the cultural plumage. It looks good on paper, right? But they're not aligned, right? Where they maybe overlooked the player who, you know, is the incumbent on the team, doesn't have the obvious domain experience around that piece, but they're really well aligned. They know the players, they have the IP and the institutional history, and they've got the trust of across the organization and so forth. But just because they haven't operated yet in that mode, people have a hard time making that leap. Yeah. And so I've seen that pitfall commonly, where we go for the bright, shiny candidate, so to speak, but we've missed the alignment of those things. So the pedigree is, you know, falling prey to the pedigree.
Right.
And again, it's not to suggest that pedigree isn't important, but sometimes we over-index on that. And so being careful to put that in the context of what truly is most important here. Learning agility is a really important trait. Coachability. And if you have someone who comes in and they have all the answers, beware.
Yeah, right.
Beware. And a lot of times organizations conflate confidence with competence, and that's often not the case.
Yeah. So what kind of questions do you ask, perhaps in an interview, to find out what somebody's values are?
That's a great question. It's going to be contextual, but I think to the extent that the research shows that the behavioral interviews, they're not good predictors, right? And so if you can engage in some kind of case or simulation or micro work product where you're not abusing or taking advantage of the candidate's time, or you're compensating them for that. But if you can have them simulate, so for example, when I applied for a professor role, they had me teach a class, right? Instead of asking me, what's your philosophy and how you teach and interact in the classroom, show me. Right. So thinking about how can you create those kinds of simulation experiences again, and that's why I say it's contextual depending on the nature of the role. One of my early corporate roles that I had, we had three interviewers, and it had the standard behavioral stuff, which was fine, whatever. But the most telling one tended to be there was a person who did the role profile, and their role was to share, you know, the role and allow them to ask questions. And inherently what happened is the person tended to be the candidate tended to be their most authentic self there, because they didn't think they were being assessed. And so they would ask the questions, the nature of the questions, and when they were more concerned about the free food in the cafeteria or this or that, or, you know, that was telling. And
sure.
There was sort of the rule was three thumbs up. And oftentimes it came down to the role profile, how they interact, were they respectful of the people they interacted with and so forth. How many times have you heard, you know, disrespecting, you know, the administrative person at the front desk and so forth, right? And so looking for those ways to get folks in their actual elements can be helpful at mitigating some of those hiring decisions, but it's not foolproof. Asking some of those values-based questions and how that has manifested for them and what does that mean, and some of those hypothetical questions where you can really drill down to get away from the sense on how and why they think that way and what they do with that can be helpful as well.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that, you know, how I know we had a boss not too long ago that would ask the receptionist right after the interview.
Exactly.
He would call down and he would say, how were they?
Yeah.
What'd you think? what were they like when they walked in? And if
and
she
they could make or break you.
They 100%. 100%.
That's exactly right.
Great interview, terrible, first impression with the receptionist or upset or whatever. And he's like, done. Because you just don't need that, you know? And I agree with you. I think also observing the language that they use when they're describing these things, you know, is super important to see how negative or positive they are in their language for optimism or pessimism. That's good. I think hiring is one of the things that it's such a crapshoot, you know, and we could be better at it. And I know that there's a lot of statistics and stuff like that out there, but I really like the fact that you said that behavioral is not as good as we thought it was. I think it was an evolution from where we were, and we just need to continue evolving. You know, we kind of get stuck in this worked once, this is going to work forever, and we're just not there anymore.
And one of the other interesting things on the behavioral track there is that because you can train out, you can coach up, and everyone knows what the behavioral standard behavioral questions are, right?
And
folks who do a good job prepping for that, but that's a different skill set than actually doing it. Conversely, and this comes back to the diversity perspective, right? Not everyone has that same experience around prepping for those or knowing those. Sometimes there can be some diamond in the rough. And so looking beyond the obvious polished questions, some people just don't perform as well in that context. And looking for that diamond in the rough can be really powerful, so you don't overlook.
Yeah. And also getting out of the office, right? We often took people to lunch just to see what their interaction with the server was like, or, you know, if they messed up their order and what they would be like with the messed up order and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, kind of getting people to relax so that they can just be themselves, because this is ultimately who they're going to be in your workplace. So very, very, very good. What's one leadership principle that you found to be universal, no matter the context or the size of the organization?
Put me on the spot here.
Could take your time.
I think that, how should I say this so it doesn't sound trite, right? The more real you can be, the more you can have, there's a helpful model called the Map of Meaningful Work by Dr. Mario Lipsquirsma, and she talks about having integrity with self. And so the more you can have integrity with yourself in the context of the role you're doing, that's going to be a predictor of the staying power for you in that role. Right? So that would probably be my off the cuff answer. If you gave me more time to think about it, I might amend that, but that's what's coming top of mind to me.
No, that's good. I don't know if we know that enough. I don't know that we say that often enough, but your self-reflection of you holding yourself accountable to how you did today is definitely, and it has to be universal, right? Because it's so self reflective, that if you knew that you didn't do, for example, if I had a conversation with someone and I knew that I could have had a better conversation, or I was a little emotionally charged, you know, going home and thinking about why I was emotionally charged and going back the next day to apologize about it it's everything, right? It's being able to do that. And so I think your answer was spot on, because self-reflection is, I think it's the foundation of you being a better person, a better leader, all the things, you know, being able to look at how you were.
And that's a great example of being able to apologize when you're wrong. It comes back to that humility, right?
Yeah.
It's that old myth of, you know, it's never having to apologize, feel like you have to apologize.
Yeah.
That's bad counsel.
BS. I call BS on that. Yeah. Nobody, and sometimes it's funny because, I mean, it happens to me from time to time. Of course, I'm human. And when I go back to apologize, the person's like, oh, no, you're fine. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, I just need you to know that I know inside of me, I wasn't as calm, or I didn't use the right language, or that wasn't my intent. And it just helps the relationship grow so much more, because they know that I can hold myself accountable to even something that...
Put a deposit in the trust bucket, right?
I love that. Putting deposits in, 100%. So let's talk about your triathlete and your community theater a little bit. I want to get to know you on a personal level. So how did you get into triathlete? And do you still compete?
I compete with myself, right?
Right.
And so it was probably, I don't know, 15, 20, it's probably come about 20 years or so ago. I had gotten to a point where I was not working out. I was on anti-anxiety meds. I was carrying an extra 40 pounds. I was not in a healthy spot. My wife, we need to fix this, right? So we went to a spin class. 6 minutes in, I had to quit. I'm like, this, I was embarrassed, but I went back. But our spin teacher, Felicia, she was a dynamo, and she inspired my wife to do a sprint distance triathlon. And I went and watched and cheered my wife on. There were like 3,000 folks. It was an all women's triathlon. And there was a 76-year-old participating. There were multiple cancer survivors participating. I remember one woman gets out of the lake and two people rushed her aid. And I'm like, oh no, is she in trouble? And no, they were just bringing her her crutches so she could go to the next line. I cried three times that day out of sheer inspiration. And I'm like, I have no excuse. And so I got inspired to train for my first triathlon, and that started a whole journey. And I did the sprint, my first one. I talk about this in some of my writing, but my first attempt, I didn't practice enough open. I didn't practice any open water swimming, panicked and had them pull me out. So it took me 2 years to get the gumption. I did the sprints for about 10, 15 years during COVID. I'm like, let's challenge yourself. Let's train for an Olympic distance. Hired a tri coach to do that. They're addictive when you do them. Yep. And then eventually I said, let's do a half Ironman. Had a similar experience. I hadn't trained enough with the open water, so I didn't finish the first attempt, but it made me want to go back and do it even more. So I finished a couple half Ironmans the last two summers. And for me, it's just been, and I'm slow. I'm slow as molasses, right? But it's a personal challenge, and it has so many metaphors for me to life, right? We all have our own. We can pick your own metaphorical triathlons that you want to choose. Something hard. You do the hard things that push yourself to create discipline, to create habit, to show you that you are resilient, you can do things. And it's just become very powerful from a physical health perspective, but just to, as a metaphor for how I kind of try to lead my life.
Yeah, that growth mindset of, you know, I'm not good at this and I'm still going to go at it. You went at it, you practiced, you didn't finish, and then you went back. I think that that's like that piece of going back. It's obviously it's emotional because, you know, so many people quit right there.
I race to complete, not to compete. And one of my friends, he's actually a classmate of my dad's. So he's probably 76 or 78 year old. And we often see each other in the pool. We compete in the local tri. He's, all you got to do, Patrick, is just stick around long enough. And then you'll start placing your age group like I do. Right. So that's that's my strategy, is to be like, Ken, I'm just going to keep doing it. And eventually I'll start placing.
I love that. Yeah. Patrick, what are some of your final thoughts?
I will just offer that, you know, our book is coming up.
Yes.
You know, we want to be of service when that's available for any of your listeners. We have a lot of resources in there. Our goal is to get this out to the world and be of service. So if folks want to look us up online, we're very happy to help if you're struggling with anything on their teams, coaching, development, et cetera. Look us up and feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn or through our website.
And where can they find you on those socials?
Our website is adlucemgroup.com, AdlucemGroup. And then my LinkedIn is Patrick Farran, Farran. Mention in the connection request that you heard this podcast here. Otherwise, they'll know you're not a spammer. I'm happy to connect and be a resource in any way that I can. We try to put a lot of content out to the world to be of service to folks.
Very, very, very beautiful. And we'll have all those links in the show notes. And one thought you want to leave the listeners with.
The world needs you. More than ever now, the world needs you. So figure out what that, if you don't already know, most people probably know at some level, right? And think about, how can I show up in this world and to be who I need to be?
Yeah. Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Yes. Likewise.
Thank you, guys. And that concludes our episode of Leadership from the Heart. Thank you guys for listening. If you like it, if you like the episode, please like and share and subscribe. We'll see you guys next time on another episode.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.